This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a world of difference between considering the Gulf crisis from the United States and looking at it from Iraq, according to Trudy Rubin. Rubin left Baghdad for Amman, Jordan, Friday, after spending nearly 2 weeks in Iraq. Rubin is a Mideast expert on the editorial board of the Philadelphia Inquirer. She spoke with us earlier today from Amman and described how things looked from Baghdad.
When you're inside Iraq, you realize how many troubles there are within the country. You also realize that in some ways Saddam Hussein is more popular in other parts of the Arab world than he is at home. When you're inside Baghdad, you're aware of the terrible fear that people have, that they're going to be bombed, that they're being dragged into a war. There's a tremendous unhappiness at the massive conscription, which has gone down to 17 years of age. It's causing enormous hardship. People feel that they have absolutely no power over their lives. They're frightened, and they just don't know what to do. So you see that the society is uneasy, unhappy. They're not able to do anything about it. And they're also going deeper and deeper into the economic hole.
You know, in the United States, President Bush has compared Saddam Hussein with Hitler, not only because he's a brutal dictator, but because of the potential power that he has in the region that he operates in. Do you think that that's a good comparison?
I think that it's an exaggeration. There is no question that this is a bad man. You cannot be in that country and not just be overwhelmed at the cult of personality, at the fear that he has instilled in people. When people talk to you, sometimes they'll whisper to you and make a motion across their throat. And basically what they're telling you is that if it was known they were talking to you, they would literally be killed. This man does not play softball. On the other hand, this is a country of 17 million people that's in deep economic trouble. It's true, it's sitting on huge oil resources, so that gives it a real leg up. But it's not in a position to dominate the world. This is a regional troublemaker. You have to keep in perspective that this is not a man with unlimited resources. And in a sense, I think that by building him up, not only have we created the image of a monster that is greater than the reality, but in addition, I think he has bought into the line that that the United States has been creating. And I think his image of himself has increased to the point where he thinks of himself as a mini superpower.
Well, while you were in Baghdad, did you get a sense of being hated for being American?
No, and I think this is one of the most amazing and really poignant experiences that I and most other Americans who were there as journalists had. One of the funny parts, if I guess it was funny, was that in the beginning, the first few days I was there, when people would hear that I was American, they would think I was a hostage who didn't get out. People were always asking, did you miss the plane? And, of course, then when they would find out you were a journalist, they would get a little nervous. But basically, people were very open to Americans. Enormous numbers of people have relatives in the States, which they were always telling you about. I must have met a dozen people who had planned trips to the States that last summer and had to cancel them because of the August 2nd invasion. I never met somebody who expressed animosity towards Americans. You know, basically, they would come up when they found out you were American. Somehow they thought maybe you could tell them if there was going to be a war. People were always asking me, is there going to be a war? And asking me what they could do. And it was a very strange and painful feeling to be talking to people who are really innocent pawns caught up in this and who are asking me, an American, what they could do to avoid American bombs.
If we didn't attack Iraq, but we tried to go with sanctions for a longer time, do you think that they'd be effective?
I came out very dubious about the possibility of sanctions alone changing Saddam Hussein's mind, even though I also came out very disquieted about the likely repercussions of war throughout the area. The problem with sanctions is that the part of the sanctions which most affect ordinary people and therefore have the most potential to create unrest are the part of the sanctions that are working the least well, and that has to do with food and basic supplies of life. The stores are just full of food 5 months after the embargo started. And on those areas where there's any danger that you might get public unrest, for example, gasoline rationing, there was a rumor, it was more than a rumor, that they were going to introduce coupons, and that caused fights at gas stations, and so they immediately rescinded that. But as long as there's no shortage of bread, I was told repeatedly by by people there and by diplomats who've been there a long time, and I could sort of see with my own eyes, they just have access. They have had a very good harvest this fall. They put in an extra harvest, which they're hoping for a bumper crop in the spring. There's a lot of foodstuffs that have come in from Kuwait. There just is not the kind of shortages that's going to cause real difficulties for him. And while there's beginning to be shortages of spare parts and small light industry is shutting down, that's a very small sector of the economy. So I think it would be a very long-range process. I think where you do see problems is that he's running out of cash, and so they're revving up the printing presses, and that means that inflation's going to set in. But again, you know, that's a process. I think it would be a long time before you'd see a rebellion. So the problem is that I think sanctions would be a very, very long-range game, and he's willing to let his own people suffer.
Trudy Rubin is on the editorial board of the Philadelphia Inquirer. She spoke to us from Amman, Jordan. Some of the roots of today's conflict in the Gulf can be traced back to 1922. That's when the European nations that were victorious after World War I divided up the fallen Ottoman Empire. They redrew the map of the Middle East, creating new nations and new borders. My guest David Fromkin is the author of a book on the creation of the modern Middle East. He gave it the intentionally ironic title, A Peace to End All Peace. France and England were the two primary powers that reshaped the map of the region. Fromkin says the new nations they created were really artificial state systems.
There had been kings and emperors since time immemorial, but the particular kings who were appointed and put on thrones by the British at that time were not native to the countries that were handed over to them to rule. More to the point, the countries themselves, in many cases, had no historical background and no reality in terms of the sense that the people of that area had that they were a nation.
We say nationalism was an alien concept, the idea of loyalty to a particular country. What was alien about it?
The basis of loyalty in the Middle East at the time and for centuries before then had principally been religion. And to the extent that it was not, the basis of loyalty was family, tribe, clan, sect, call it what you will, the locality in which you lived. Middle Easterners had loyalties that were local, except to the extent that they had religious loyalties. There were not nations or countries in the European sense or the American sense of the word, and they hadn't developed a feel for that at that time.
So when you had people of different tribes or different religions now sharing the same country, there were feuds between them, and I guess we're seeing the repercussions of that now.
Yes.
What were the European claims to the Middle East in the teens and the early 1920s? What gave them the authority to redraw the map?
It came about, really, because they won the war. But I think you have to go much, much, much further back, hundreds of years back, to when the Europeans started to explore the globe, Columbus, Vasco da Gama, back to the era of the explorers. And starting at that time, the Europeans conquered or settled every part of the rest of the world. And the Middle East was one of the few areas left, almost the only area left, as of, say, 1914, that the Europeans had not taken in hand, reorganized, and made in their own political image. The Europeans had felt for a long time that someday they would have to take the Middle East in hand, that it was not capable of governing itself. And the moment came when the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire that then ruled the Arab Middle East, recklessly and unnecessarily entered the First World War on Germany's side. And when they did that and then lost the war, that meant that Britain and France were in possession of the Middle East and in a position to determine its future.
Would you give us a quick review of which country drew and controlled which Middle East state?
Syria and what is now Lebanon were controlled by France, who drew their boundaries. And Britain was in occupation of, in control of, what is now Egypt, Israel, West Bank, Jordan, and Iraq, with protectorships over Kuwait and the other Gulf sheikdoms.
Now, how did it end up being Britain and France that took control over these states?
In the First World War, Britain was the Allied power that was most concerned in the fighting in the Middle East. It was Britain that defeated the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire. And at the end of the war in 1918, there was a million-man British army in occupation of the Middle East, and it was the only coherent military force in the entire region. That meant that Britain was in effective control of the entire Middle East.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Frumkin, and he's written a new book called A Peace to End All Peace. It's about the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the creation of the modern Middle East. When Britain and France divided up the territory and redrew new boundaries, you've told us that these boundaries didn't reflect tribal loyalties or religious loyalties. What did they reflect? How was the map redrawn? How were the boundaries decided on?
Those boundaries, in large part, reflected the administrative convenience of the occupying powers or the political realities of the situation between them.
What did the European countries want from the Middle East? Why did they want the territory?
For different reasons. Both Britain and France wanted control. They were imperialist powers that simply liked controlling a lot of things. British Prime Minister David Lloyd George felt that Britain ought to gain territory and control in the Middle East to compensate Britain for all the losses suffered during the war. Traditionally, Britain had also wanted control of that area, or at any rate wanted to exclude any enemies from control of that area in order to protect Britain's imperial road to India. The French, who were in the Middle East at the same time, in addition to feeling a sense of rivalry with England, had strong commercial and even stronger religious interests in the area as protectors of the Maronite or essentially Roman Catholic population in the Canton of Lebanon. So it was a great mix of reasons. Very late in the day, both powers discovered the importance of oil. And it was suspected that oil existed in the Middle East. They didn't know that it existed in the great quantity that we now know that it does, but that was yet one more reason for their being interested in the area. Finally, in Great Britain, there was a strong sentimental interest based on studying the Bible when everyone was children, a very strong sentimental interest in seeing to the fostering of a Jewish state, a Jewish homeland in Palestine.
Now, you say that by the time the lines of the map were redrawn and became official in 1922, Europe no longer believed in them.
It was Britain. Britain that had drawn the most lines, had been most responsible for the settlement, didn't. Britain had been changing during the war and after the war. One of the most important events that took place in the first instance had nothing to do with the Middle East. That was the very great economic collapse, the economic downturn in Britain after the war, which made the British voter feel that he didn't have the money or the resources to embark on foreign and imperial adventures, that the money and resources were needed at home to build industry and create jobs. And so for that reason, Britain turned away from the idea of foreign adventures and such. Moreover, there had been a lot of unrest in the Middle East after, and a lot of disorder after the First World War. It was evident that it was becoming evident that it would really take a lot of commitment of resources by Britain to maintain a position there, and the whole thing just started to look much less attractive than it had before. So that there were many in England, not everybody, but there were many in England, certainly in the electorate, in the parliament, in the press, that turned against the arrangements that Britain had made.
Where does the United States fit in to the creation of the modern Middle East?
The United States, too, changed its mind. Under President Woodrow Wilson, who was in office until early 1921, the United States had an idealistic program of trying to ascertain the wishes of the inhabitants of the Middle East as to what form of government they should have. As far as rhetoric was concerned, President Wilson was opposed to the extension of French and British imperialism to the Middle East. America was against imperialism. But Wilson was not effective in his opposition to Britain's plans and France's plans. Once he left office and President Harding took office, America's policy changed dramatically. We were then interested exclusively in the exploitation of oil in the Middle East. That was really our concern, our only concern. And we felt that the exploitation of oil would be facilitated by the creation of stable regimes. And in turn, our idea of a stable regime was the sort of regime that Britain would establish and administer. So we were all in favor of British rule in the Middle East, at least as much as the British were, maybe even more than the British were, under President Harding.
We're talking about a subject that's crucial to understanding what's happening now in the Gulf, and the subject is how the modern Middle East was created, how the map was redrawn after World War I and the fall of the Ottoman Empire. My guest is David Fromkin, the author of the book A Peace to End All Peace. He's an international lawyer and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Fromkin is my guest, author of the new book A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. Let's look specifically at Iraq now. Iraq was created as a British protectorate in 1922. How was it formed?
It was formed from three provinces, Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul, that were then in the possession of Great Britain, British India. Britain put the three together and made a country out of them and nominated a monarch to be their king and set them up as a country.
No, it was England that established the boundary between Saudi Arabia and Iraq, yes?
Yes, and Kuwait.
And Kuwait. Three countries in the middle of what's happening at the Gulf now. Do the conflicts between Saudi Arabia and Iraq and between Iraq and Kuwait relate at all to how England drew their boundaries in 1922?
That's a kind of red herring that Saddam Hussein introduced. The drawing of that line in 1922 should not have affected politics today. At the time, the problem for England was that she had put Faisal, an Arabian prince, on the throne of Iraq, but the great enemy, the great blood enemy in Arabian politics of Faisal's family was Ibn Saud, who created what we now know as Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud led warrior bands that were fierce and victorious. They were defeating the forces of Faisal's family everywhere in the Arab world. And Ibn Saud's forces threatened to go into Iraq, into what is now Iraq. And Ibn Saud had vast territorial claims on what is now Iraq. So to protect their protege, Faisal, and at the same time satisfy Ibn Saud, who also was a British-supported leader, British High Commissioner in Baghdad drew a frontier line between Iraq and Saudi Arabia that was favorable to Iraq and compensated Saudi Arabia, in turn, by giving Saudi Arabia two-thirds of the territory that then belonged to the city-state of Kuwait. So the loser in that settlement was Kuwait. The beneficiary was Iraq at Kuwait's expense. So it is ironic indeed that Saddam Hussein, citing the unfairness of that frontier, should have invaded Kuwait. It was really Kuwait that could have claimed that the frontier line was unfair to it.
So Iraq really has no claim, you think, to any territories in Kuwait?
None at all. No valid claim based on history, none.
Now, you say that when Iraq was created, it was a country, but it wasn't a nation. What do you mean by that distinction?
In the north of Iraq, in the province of Mosul, was a largely Kurdish population, quite distinct from the Arab inhabitants of the country, very different, with a sense of their own peoplehood, if you will. The city of Baghdad, the capital, was predominantly Jewish at the time. It was one of the two great Jewish cities of Asia, along with Jerusalem. And as far as the Arab populations of the Baghdad province and the province of Basra were concerned, they were split between Shiites and Sunnis, who did not recognize one another as being part of the same group.
So suddenly all these groups were part of one nation and had a lot of conflicts with each other.
Yes.
Do you think that there are still many people in the Arab world that have no respect for the state borders that were drawn?
Yes, I do. On the other hand, in the course of time, there are those who have sort of grown into these boundaries and into these states, artificial though they were decades ago. After all, it's nearly 70 years since those boundaries were drawn. And one of the things that I've warned against in my book is that once you start regarding one or more of these boundaries as artificial and therefore invalid, and knock it out because it's invalid, you invalidate everything. The whole region is in chaos, and it might be far better, whatever the merits of the current state system and the current frontiers, it really would in many ways be far better to accept them as they are and try to live with them, which is what the states in Africa have done, which were equally artificial. But in Africa, the Organization of African States has had the statesmanship and the good sense to say, we have to start from this departure point. All frontiers are inviolate. Let's live with them. And I think that's the way the Middle East has got to go, too, if it ever wants to achieve peace.
My guest has been David Fromkin, author of the book A Peace to End All Peace, The Fall of the Ottoman Empire and the Creation of the Modern Middle East. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.